As promised, we are gonna first establish relation between the whole conductivity and various phase. This phase, and our ultimate goal is to derive sort of a view of the whole conductivity as a topological invariant. So in the previous two lectures, we've seen that that the conductivity of the field lambda level is quantized, so it's either it's e squared over h, right? And now let's ask more generally, what are the possible values that that the whole conductivity of a field band can take? Okay, and we will see that, in fact, it is topological invariant. So the possible values of the whole conductivity are essentially some integer times e squared over h, where this integer characterizes the topological property of your band. So and the description we are going to develop is very useful because it can be applied to, you know, solids which don't have magnetic field on. So turns out some of them can also be non-trivial, and also even though there is no external magnetic field, you could have a situation where a field band gives you quantized whole conductivity. Okay, and another big advantage of the approach that we're going to develop, as you will see in a second, is that there are really no assumptions about disorder interactions and so on. So from the description, you see that the quantization survives both disorder and electron-electron interactions. So they do not spoil it. Okay. So and so we would want the whole system to be gapped. So we don't want to deal with edge states anymore. So let's put our system on a closed surface. Okay, so we've done first step of it. So we roll the strip into a loop. So let's now do the next step and consider a system sitting on a torus. Right. So we're going to consider, you know, first a sample which is rectangular. So width Lx and Ly. And let us glue these two edges together and these two edges together, okay? Such that it's a torus, and there is some magnetic field which is piercing it. So closed geometry. Torus. And let's pick once again Landau gauge, for simplicity, I will put the magnetic lengths to be one here, so that I don't have to. Yeah.
Do you want to say how you generate the magnetic field?
Let's imagine it's possible. So of course there is no way to do it in real life, but. Yes, exactly. You would need, right. In the same way, if you wanted to put it on a sphere, you would need a monopole sitting at the center of the sphere. So, you know, this is not going to be essential because we will just use this to calculate the whole conductivity of the system. Right, so and we will assume that the magnetic length is one, so we're free of all the factors. Right, so And let's pick again Landau gauge. So and let me write it up to a gauge transformation. So AX is going to be phi X over LX, and AY is going to be X plus phi Y over LY. Okay, so and for a second, you know, I can assume that phi X is a multiple of 2 pi, some 2 pi NX, and phi Y is 2 pi NY. So then this is just a gauge transformation. Right, this is a little bit, this should remind you of this argument with the flux insertion that we considered before, except now I would have it in both directions. So, for now, let me fix this to be multiples of 2 pi, but later on we will actually change this, and they can take any value later on. Yeah. Right. You pierce it with a flux, exactly.
Right. And you can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is a good way. This is a good way of looking at it. Right. And let's first thing to do, of course, since we are dealing with a closed surface, is to understand what are the boundary conditions. Right. So boundary conditions are non-trivial. And this is because you know, as we discussed very briefly, under magnetic field, the translations in the x and y direction in general do not commute, right? So to see it once again, let's write down explicitly what the translations in the x and y direction would look like. So, but first of all, formally, you know, if I denote translational operator by T of U, where U is the shift, right, is the vector by which I want to translate everything, right? So boundary condition on my wave function psi should look like that. So T of U applied to psi should be again psi, right, when I translate either by LX or by LY. Right, so when U is either it's LX 0 or it's 0 LY. And,
I don't understand the gauge transformation of the vector function, because shouldn't the gauge transformation be partial derivatives of a scalar function?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, if the phi x and phi y are supposed to be the x and y partial derivatives of a scalar function, then.
Which winds by, right. Which winds by 2 pi. No, it won't be. It won't be, right, of course. Because you can see, right, if you change the flux by 2 pi, right, this corresponds to a physical process where you transfer charge. So, of course, they're not equivalent, right? So, but formally, right, if I just solve my Hamiltonian, you know, without phi x and with phi x, I'll get the same spectrum, of course. Right, and this is analogous to this argument we discussed, right? So if you change the flux by 2 pi, you'll end up with the same Hamiltonian. But now if you vary it adiabatically, something important happens and you transfer charge, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so looking at
there is a bit more
general than the view of the transformation that we are
using. Yeah. It still preserves the
spectrum. Right, this is... It's they're equivalent only in the sense of the spectrum, right? But there is no, of course, you know, if you are to try to connect them, right? Try to connect them smoothly, then you have to transfer charge. Mm-hmm. So now let's write down the boundary conditions. But first, let's recall what this translation operator T of U does, right? So for that, remember that our Hamiltonian looks like that, right? dy plus x squared, right? So you see, you can do the transformation if you if you want to do a translation along y direction, right? You can still do it without you can still do it without changing anything, right? So then so t of u psi is simply, let me write it like that, xy is simply psi of x y plus uy, right? But now if you consider translation by a vector which is pointing along x, then this is not so, because if you simple mindedly change x by some amount ux, right, you see you'll be in trouble here, right? You will, it's going to change your Hamiltonian. So in order to compensate for this change, you also need to make a gain transformation in your wave function, so which would look like that. So effectively, you need to change the momentum by the same amount, right? So it will look like that. Uy y psi of x plus ux, sorry, ux here y. Right, so you can see that now if original one was the solution, then this one would also be the solution, because here I shifted x by ux, right? But I also shifted the momentum by ux, right? And this is expected because now we are used to the fact that that momentum in the y direction and the coordinate in the x direction are related in this gauge, right? So this is yet another manifestation of that, right? So this is what our translations look like, and now we can write down the boundary condition. So first boundary condition tells us the following, right? That T of ux0 psi sitting on the effectively psi of so here I should put lx, right? I should translate by the lx, should be equal to psi. So let's see. Interaction. Right, so I know that when I do translation in the x direction, I should also change the y coordinate, multiply it by this exponential factor. So this is the first boundary condition, right? And the second boundary condition is simpler, so it's just adding ly to y. Now, you can see that there is a consistency condition that you must require, right? Which is so you could get, let's say, so all the four corners of this thing become equivalent after we go to the torus geometry, right? So so we should require that if we go like this and like this, it should be equivalent to going like this and like this, right? So which tells us that if we first apply translation in x and then in y, it should be the same as the translation in x and y should be the same as y and x, right? For this particular vectors, right? So this tells us that t of, you know, lx0 t of 0 ly should be the same, right, as t of lx0 t of 0 ly. And you can easily work out that these two guys differ by a phase, which is in fact, they differ by a phase, which is simply I lx ly. Right, this is because first time shifting, if I first shifted in the y direction, then I added this ly, and then once I shift in the x direction, I would get extra factor of lx ly coming from this exponent. Right, so in order for the for those boundary conditions to be self-consistent, I need to require that lx ly is in multiple of 2 pi. Right, so that, yeah.
Why do we have to require that even the phases are the same?
Well, remember, this is the same wave function, right? So it's just I'm trying to see which way should I so what kind of wave function I should find on this rectangular sample such that when I glue it, it will make sense, right? So this is the same wave function, but you're right that, you know, in general, right, if those were different, then it's only up to a phase. Okay. So now that we have our setup, next thing we are gonna do is we are gonna start varying this fluxes phi x and phi y, right? Effectively piercing the torus with this solenoids, and we are gonna use it to calculate the Hall conductivity, right? And intuitively, you can probably foresee it from the argument we discussed at the end of the last lecture, right? That if you pierce your system with the flux, right, this in general induces current and voltage, right? So effectively, you know, we are going to vary this fluxes or the boundary conditions, right, to obtain Hall conductivity. Okay, so and so we are going to use the general Kuba formula, which is, you know, a general thing in the linear response theory. So let me just ask you, so how familiar are you with the Kuba formula? Not familiar, right? Okay, so then we are going to review it as well. So auxiliary fact we are going to need is the Kuba formula. So let me just explain the logic behind this, and then we will just use the standard expression which you can find in many textbooks and which would actually make intuitive sense. So imagine you have some system, right? You know, let's say could be a Fermi gas, could be anything, any general, you know, many body system. And imagine you are, let's say, applying electric field, and you want to know what kind of current you would obtain, right? So then, you know, using perturbation theory, you can always relate, let's say, the current, or let me consider a more general situation. Let me say I apply perturbation or some field which is described by this operator B, right? This is my field, and I want to know the current which is described by some operator A. Right. Then, assuming that this perturbation is small, you can do. Assuming that this field is weak, right? You can do perturbation theory, and not surprisingly, you find that the averaged induced current is simply proportional to B, right? With some proportionality constant, right? Which is called susceptibility, right? And you can, when you think about it, always think about the analogy with the electric current, right? So this would be the analog of the usual relation between the current and electric field. But this is a lot more general, right? So within the, if you assume that this B field is weak, right? So you can limit yourself only to the lowest order and can neglect the higher order terms, you know, go as B squared and so on. Then this is all there is to it. So there's a linear relation between the current and the field, and the Huber formula essentially tells you how to relate this susceptibility to some average of the commutator of these two operators at different time over the ground state, which is unperturbed. And the way how you can even derive it is by effectively thinking, okay, I have a perturbation, it's gonna change my wave function, right? And then I can analyze this change in the perturbation theory to the leading order in B, and then I can evaluate the average current over this perturbed state, right? By keeping only the first correction. So first corrections would be proportional to B, and then once you plug in A, you would get effectively a product of A and B, and once you work it all out and do all the math right, you would see that you always end up with a commutator of A and B. Okay?
So someone might be wondering where T enters, since you didn't have T.
Yes, this is a good question. So we'll see, it will always look like that. It will be some integral over dt. And this this is just a convenient way to write it down, right? Because remember, when you do perturbation theory, your corrections to the wave function would look like that. It will be, you know, B matrix element ground state I, right, E0 minus EI, where I is excited state, right? And then I can just rewrite this energy. I can say, okay, so let me rewrite it like that. Let me write it like integral of dt 0 to the minus I ht b e I ht I, right, times from 0 to infinity times state I. Right, because now I can act with this guy to the left and just get the ground state energy, this guy to the right, and I will get excited state energy, and once I integrate, I will get exactly this factor. Right? So this is just probably from this short introduction, you can see the main ingredients which go into it, and how, you know, you can use it to actually get the Kubo formula even yourself. But for today, let me just use the answer, which will look exactly like this. And the quantities I will be interested in would be fluxes and currents. Mm-hmm. You have a question? Okay. Fluxes and currents. So the current is related to the current density J in a very simple way, right? So I just need to multiply Jx by Ly by the length, and Iy is simply Jy Lx. This is simple. Then the current density can be related to the, very generally can be related to the variation of the Hamiltonian with respect to the vector potential. Right, so this is a familiar fact. Now let me use the following relation. So you can, from this and the relation between vector potential and flux, right? So because remember, Ax was related, so it was phi x over Lx. And same thing for y. So let me use it to rewrite the current. So you can check that you can write the current as a variation of H of the Hamiltonian with respect to these fluxes. Okay? So, and A could be either X or Y here. Right, so which tells you that the Hamiltonian can be written like that. So Hamiltonian can be some part H naught which does not depend on the phis, plus or minus here, right? It would be delta phi. So let me call it delta phi A times the current. Right? So now we are in a good position. Now we can use this Kubo formula by treating, so we're gonna treat, you know, phi as perturbation, and then we're gonna find the current, right, which we induce once in response to delta phi. Mm-hmm. So in this case, the Kubo formula takes the following form. So let me assume that I vary these fluxes at some finite frequency, which is going to be small. And in a second, you will see why. Because essentially, in order to obtain the conductivity, we will need to take the limit of very small frequencies. But again, the fact that you need to introduce the time dependence into fluxes should be obvious to you from our gauge argument in the last lecture, because you remember there if you just introduce flux, nothing happens. But if you look at the time dependence of what happens once you introduce it, right, this is when the current flows. Okay, so here is the same thing. So it should be susceptibility of AB, delta phi B, function of omega, where the susceptibility is given by expression of the type that I mentioned, I omega t dt. Now, we're going to be interested in the low frequencies when, as you can check, this susceptibility is simply proportional to the conductivity. And why is that? This is because flux means vector potential. Derivative of flux means electric field, right? So if you have derivative of flux, it means that it means that the vector potential is varying in time, and its derivative gives you exactly electric field. Right, this is why, you know, this expression I can modify by saying that, okay, so delta phi B derivative with respect to time is I omega delta phi B, right? But at the same time, this is electric field, right? So I can rewrite this relation like this, IA of omega equals kappa AB of omega times electric field over I omega, right? So which tells me that the conductivity is exactly kappa chi so, divided by I omega, right? This is what I've written down here. Mm-hmm. So effectively, we want to find the conductivity, we need to find the limit now, limit of omega going to zero, derivative of d chi d omega, right? And so it will be convenient for me to calculate this limit by taking omega to be complex. So let me take omega to be I over tau, where tau is very large. Very large and positive. So it's just a trick to calculate this limit. So then as a next step, I will rewrite it in a symmetric form. So I will write kappa d omega. So I will take a derivative of this expression with respect to omega. So I'll just get omega here, right? So I can say that this is simply I integral 0 to infinity this commutator iat ib 0 commutator times t e to the I omega t dt. And let me do a trick and let me write it in the following form. Let me introduce extra integration. So there will be now two times over which I integrate. So first time I'm still integrating from 0 to infinity, and the second time I will integrate from minus infinity to 0. So I'm doing this just to give this expression a symmetric form. Okay? So to see that in fact these two quantities are the same, what you need to do, you need to do a change of variables in this one. So you need to say that okay, t equals t1 minus t2 and t prime equals t1 plus t2. And once you carry out the integration over t prime, you find that all that it gives you is this factor of t. Okay, so you're back to the same expression. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now I can write it down in an even simpler form. So I can write it down as a simple commutator of two operators which I called Q, and I will write down their definition in a second. So Q A plus simply comes from this integral, so this and this, right? So it's integral of I A of T minus T over tau dt, and Q B minus is integral minus infinity to 0 I B of T e to the T tau dt, right? So QA comes from the integration over T1, and QB comes from the integration over T2. And you know, you can see their physical meaning from this right away, right? So it effectively it carries the meaning of charge, transfer charge, right? So it's integral of the current over time, right? So it's a charge you transfer in some process, and in what process we will see in a second. So let's show now that these charges can be related. They're nothing else but the charges that they're related to a process where you slowly turn on the flux, right? So let's start with no flux and then let's turn it on. So delta phi A of t would be t of tau, so delta phi A. Right, so this would be final value, and we start with 0, and then we slowly turn it on, and we stop at t equals 0. Right? So how can we link this Q to such a process? So we need to look essentially at the change in the wave function. Right, so our Hamiltonian, recall our Hamiltonian, so it's H0 minus sum over A delta phi A IA, right, so this is the operator, and we can treat this guy as a perturbation. Right, so then in the lowest order perturbation theory, we can find a change in the wave function. So we can see that the, let's say, initial state was psi, and let's find delta psi. So delta psi, as you can easily see, so it's simply an integral minus I perturbation dependent on time, times dt, right? So it's delta, call me, this is delta h of t times dt from minus infinity to zero. Mm-hmm. Right? And once you do that, you see that once you use this and this, you see that delta psi is, so it's I, so there's no delta phi a integral I a of t e to the t over tau dt. This is I delta phi a q a minus psi. Right, so effectively this tells you that under such a process you you change your wave function by this amount, which is given exactly by this operator q a acting on your initial state. Mm-hmm. Is this part clear?
Aren't you missing the state and the steps in between?
Hmm? Missing
the cat.
Missing what?
The cat.
Yeah.
The cat.
Yeah, the cat. Yeah.
Ah, here. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So now let's recall. So let's recall that we are interested in the gap systems. Right, so under such a process of turning on flux, we can use the adiabatic approximation. Right, so we assume that the gap is still there. Right, so under such a process, you know you are gonna stay in the ground state. Right, so next important step is to invoke. Adiabatic approximation. Right, so you know that your state psi is always the ground state, which is function of this phi in general, right? Of course, up to a phase factor, which won't be important. So now this tells us that under this evolution, right, if we insert a flux, we could use this answer or we could use this answer. So now we can relate them, right? We can see that the change, you know, looking at this expression, I could say that the change in wave function is proportional, right? It's simply delta phi a, right, times derivative d psi over d phi a. Right, so from this you see that I could use either this or this one, and by comparing them, I get a very useful relation between the how the wave function changes under the insertion of the flux, how the ground state wave function changes under the insertion of the flux, and this operator Q. Right, so I get that QA minus psi equals minus I d psi d phi a. Right? And now you can see where I'm going with this, right? This is a charge transferred, which in some way we know must be related to the conductivity. And on the right hand side, this is some very sort of topological property of the wave function, how it changes when I change the boundary condition, right? And then of course there is another relation on this Qs. So if you turn perturbation on and then turn it off, nothing changes, right? So you're forced to say that QA minus plus QA plus should be zero, right? And we will use it in a second. So now we have all the ingredients, right? So we have the relation between the conductivity and the commutator of Qs. And here we have a relation between the Qs acting on the ground state wave function and the topological properties of this wave function. So let's just put them together. So let's plug in this guy here and let's relate the conductivity to how the wave function changes when we introduce this phi. So you can see quite easily that the answer is quite simple. So it's let me just keep xy component of the conductivity here. D phi x, d psi d phi y, minus d psi d phi y, d psi d phi x. Okay? So now of course, last step we need to take here is the following. So if you're thinking about a process where you're passing current through a sample, right? You will have to, in order for current to flow, you would have to keep increasing the flux, right? So effectively, you would keep increasing the flux, and every time you go by 2 pi, you would pump some charge, right? And you would keep increasing in order to keep the current going. So, but this effectively tells you that these phases in the physical process they change, right? So this means that to get the physical answer, you need to average over the possible values of these phases. And you know these phases are defined modulo 2 pi. Right? So last step is to say that, okay, that in a physical process, phi x and phi y vary continuously. So we need to average over them. But since we know that some value phi x is equivalent to phi x plus 2 pi, right, then it's enough to average them over the, let's say, phi x lying between 0 and 2 pi. And phi y, same for phi y, right? And such an averaging gives you the following remarkable formula. It's double integral d phi x d phi y, so 0 to pi, 0 to pi over 2 pi squared. And here we have our expression. Mm-hmm. Now, so and this is just for the reference, it's called the it has a long name, so it's called, shortly it's called TKNN formula, and this comes from the names of the people who first came up with it. So it's Taulis, whose name you in general would hear a lot if you study condensed matter, localization, and so on. Komoto, and these guys have difficult last names, so you don't, and this is, main place where you see it, so you don't really need to know those names. So now this formula should remind you of the Beres phase that we discussed, right? So remember that we establish that if you change your Hamiltonian as a function of some parameter and you look at the evolution of the wave function, it picks up non-trivial phase, right? So recall Berry phase. Right, so if you have a wave function which varies as a function of some parameters, and let me call them phi x and phi y, because these are my parameters now, right? And you make some closed loop, let's call it gamma, right? Then the phase you pick up is given by the integral over this closed trajectory, gamma, right, of, so it was psi d phi, right? That was our answer. And now you can establish the connection between this guy and this guy very, very simply, right? You can involve the Stokes theorem and write it as an integral over the area encircled by this, right? And so let me move here. And you will see that I can rewrite this Berry's phase as the integral over the area. So let me call this gamma large, right? D phi x, d phi y, times the, what I'm gonna call f x y, where f x y is obtained, you know, from this guy, right? So it's must be dx psi dy minus dy psi dx, right? And you see that if you act with this d here, it will cancel out, because there is also one which you get from acting with this guy here. So, but if you act here, then it stays. So this is d phi x, sorry. So this is d psi d phi y. Sorry, it should be all phi y here. Phi y, phi x. Right? So this is called the Berry curvature, right? And you see that to find the Berry phase picked up around some loop, you need to find the integral of the Berry curvature over this loop, right? And now compare it to our answer, right? So this is exactly the integral. So this is exactly the relation between the Hall conductivity and the integral of the Berry curvature over the whole sort of brilliant zone in this case, right? So which means you can think about it like this. You can unfold your brilliant zone into a rectangle, and you can think that this integral, right, this integral of the Berry curvature over the whole thing is equal to the Berry phase picked up when you go around, right? And now this of course has to be a multiple of 2 pi, right? Because you know that phase can only wind by 2 pi n. So this is how you see that this Hall conductivity has to be an integer of 2 pi, right? This is the only thing which is allowed, right? So you get that sigma xy is 2 pi n. Those are the only allowed values. And 2 pi here came, you could wonder where did, you know, what happened to the units, what happened to the 2 pi. right? And what happened here is that, remember, we were working on the units where magnetic length, H bar, C, we are all one, right? So I need to restore the dimensional units now, and the thing that has dimension of conductivity is E squared over H bar, right? Oh, wait, I think. And also, I have 2 pi squared here. So, so it's over 2 pi, right?
Yeah.
So it's over 2 pi. So it's E squared over H times N. So we are back to our answer. So now, if you want to think about it in more sort of mathematical terms, you can think about about how the wave function varies as some kind of, it is called vector bundle, so it's not very important, but the important thing is that this quantity is effectively the invariant, right? Invariant of the surface and the wave function, right? So it cannot be changed under small deformations. So maybe let's consider let's go back to a simple example to get some more intuition about it. So let's go back to the case of spin 1/2, right? And let's again consider the Berry curvature and related to how we have to define the wave function. So one important property which we will now see with the example of spin is the following. So if this quantity is non-trivial, right? If you're picking up some Berry's phase when you go around, it means you cannot find a single parameterization of the wave function over the whole surface, right? Because if you could, then you know it would have to be zero, right? If you enclose the loop. So this means, but let's analyze it again with this simpler example of the spin 1/2. So let's consider a sphere with a unit, so with unit vector u, which parameterizes the points on the sphere, and let's consider the Hamiltonian, which is simply h u times sigma, right? So spin 1/2, where sigma is a Pauli matrix. You can easily solve it for the ground state, and what you find is that there are multiple ways in which you can pick the ground state wave function, right? Because it's defined up to a phase. So one possible parameterization you find is the following. So it's, and let me call actually the angles parameterizing u theta as usual. So it would be theta and this angle would be phi, right? So one parameterization is, looks like that, right? So where theta varies from 0 to pi, and phi varies from 0 to pi, and phi varies from 0 to 2 pi. Now, there is a problem with this parameterization, right? At the south pole, where this sign becomes 1, it becomes poorly defined, right? Because here this guy is 1, and this one changes like crazy as you go around, right? So when you're here, it changes very quickly, so it becomes singular in the south pole. So now you could do another thing, and you could pick another parameterization of the same ground state, which turns out, so you can, again, if you're curious, you can easily check it, but it would look like that. So it will simply differ by this factor e to the minus phi here, minus I phi here, instead of here, right? And again, this parameterization is good everywhere apart from the North Pole. So there is a singularity in the North Pole. Same thing happens. This guy is one, so this one starts changing very rapidly. So this tells you that you cannot find a single parameterization of this wave function on the whole sphere, right? So what you need to do, you will need to have maps, right? You will need to, let's say, use this parameterization in the, well, let me actually plot again. So you will need to use this parameterization in the northern hemisphere, right? And this one in the southern hemisphere. And here you would need to define the way how they're glued together, right? And so this gives you a very different view on the whole thing, right? Now it becomes a property of the surface, and it becomes a question of how you parameterize it, how many maps you need and how they're glued together. And you can easily see, right, that here we have some, here the wave functions can differ by a phase, so only and only by a phase, because they're ultimately the same wave function. So let me call it some phase phi 1 2. So this is a gluing phase, right? So which glues together these two maps. And this topological invariant is simply the winding number of this gluing phase. So how can you see this? So you could say that, okay, phi 1 2 is a difference of phase here, right, and phase here, minus phi 2. Now, if I integrate the if I integrate it over equator, right, I get integral d phi 1, integral d phi 2. What is this guy? I can use the Stokes theorem to relate it to the integral of the Berry curvature here, right, in the northern hemisphere. So this is integral Berry curvature, so let me call it FAB du, well, d phi d theta over north, right? And this one will be minus the same thing over south, except now there is a different orientation here, right? So I still keep my minus sign. So I have to change the sign, actually, right? So it's minus, but then orientation is different. So in the Stokes theorem, we'll get the opposite thing. So it would be FAB d phi d theta over south. So this tells you that this winding number of the phase is simply the integral of the Berry curvature over the whole sphere, right? So, and of course, for the case of spin, you know, we know that this is this winding number is 2 pi, and the integral of the Berry curvature is also 2 pi, right? So this just we've considered to essentially illustrate, right, that there are two very different viewpoints you can take on this, right? You could think about the Berry curvature and phases you pick up, right? Or you can think about how to parameterize your surface and this maps and gluing phases, okay? So, and just the last thing about this whole approach is that, you know, nowhere in this discussion did we use any assumptions about disorder interactions and so on, right? So all we used is the effectively topological properties of how wave function changes under the changes in the boundary condition. So one implication of this is in particular that quantum Hall effect would be very robust with respect to interactions disorder as long as you don't close the gap, right? So because this invariant cannot change abruptly, right? So in order for it to change, you need to really go through some singular point which corresponds to effectively closing the gap, right? So and there are many applications and extensions of this to the band structure and the absence of magnetic field, topological insulators, and so on. So this is difficult, but important and useful thing. So guys, questions?
I don't understand from where it follows that we have to identify pi x with pi x plus 2 pi.
So you know that the ground, so you know that the spectrum is exactly the same, right? Right, because effectively the boundary conditions you need to impose, right? All this thing changes is the boundary condition. And the boundary condition you need to impose is exactly the same, if it's 0 or 2 pi, right? And since psi here is a ground state, right? You know that ground state at, you know, phi x equal to pi should be the same as the ground state at phi x equals 0. Mm-hmm. You guys, more questions?
So this sigma x y is basically the flux through the torus along the phi x y y in the coordinates, right? So
right, exactly.
So, but I mean, why does it have to be linear again? Because if you have a closed loop compact.
Yes, because I can represent it as a Berry phase, right? As a Berry phase, I pick up when I go around the whole thing.
So when you, no matter. Whatever the closed loop is.
No, but it's not whatever. Yeah, well, that's also true, right? Whatever the closed loop is, you can only pick up 2 pi n.
But why does it have to be like around the system? You have the square picture, you could go around the. I mean, in principle, you can choose the area within the 0 to 2 pi, 0 to 2 pi. Some trivial patch on your torus, right? Doesn't enclose the whole torus, it's just a trivial patch. Then you go around that loop, your phase orbit still has to be 2 pi n.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean.
Right, it's only, so right, you're right, but if you take arbitrary loop, you won't get 2 pi.
You'll only get 0, presumably.
No, you can get, you'll get the integral of the pericurvature, right?
Okay.
It doesn't have to be, right, if you make a very small loop, you'll pick up, you know, for example, if you consider the spin, right, you can make a small loop, right?
Yes.
And then you would pick up something which is not 2 pi. There's more questions. Okay, then let's continue. So we have a lecture tomorrow.